Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today our show features an interview with Helen Horvath. She is a rarity in politics, an independent candidate running for Congress in the 50th District against indicted Congressman Duncan Hunter and several challengers. She's not affiliated with any political party, and she'll be sharing her ideas on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. My very special guest today is Helen Horvath. She is a candidate running for the 50th Congressional District seat held by Duncan Hunter, who goes on trial in January, as many of you know, on federal corruption charges. Helen is running as an independent, not affiliated with any party, in the March 3rd primary election. She's an Alpine resident and Army veteran who has worked for 20 years as a federal employee, including with the Army and Navy, Military Sealift Command, Social Security, and the Department of Agriculture. Her background includes healthcare, IT, and management experience. She owns a business that's done research for the Navy, and she's met with local officials on various ideas for reducing county expenditures and increasing federal funding. She's also worked as a college professor, consultant, marriage and family therapist. She's a mother and a grandmother, and she knows a little something about overcoming adversity. As a high school dropout who went on to earn a PhD, a doctoral degree. Locally, she's served on the San Diego Military and Veterans Advisory Council, and she says she's not just running for Congress, but applying for a job that supports our individual and global community. She hopes to change laws and regulations to improve the quality of lives, and she's here today to share her ideas on how she wants to accomplish that. Helen, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here, Miriam.
So, what made you decide to run for Congress?
I was working on a project for Navy, and we keep running into the same issue with the bureaucracy. I knew that my program would save $55 to $110 million for Department of Defense in 1 year. And we're still dickering around with approving the project. And it's been a year and a half. So I figured run for Congress and get their attention and make the change through laws and regulations.
What made you decide to run as an independent, not aligned with either the Republican or the Democratic Party?
I examined both the Republican and Democratic Party platforms. I contacted Tony Kravick, who's the chair or president volunteer of the local Republican Party. I asked him in June if he would accept a person who's not known in the community and what would happen if Duncan Hunter were found guilty. He said, we'll get there when we get there. And in the meantime, we have Bill Wells and Carl DeMaio to run. And I don't believe in their political platform. So the Democrats also, I don't believe in all of their issues. And so I chose to run as an independent.
So like much of the electorate out there, really, you have some values from one party and some from the other, maybe.
Most definitely. I've always raised in both Democrat and Republican. I have congressional friends from both parties. And it's just important that we are able to work together across the aisle. An independent party would give that to us.
Interesting. What do you consider your most important qualifications for this job?
First, I know what it's like to struggle and learn to be something different. But most of all, it's in addition to my life education, it's my university education and my expertise as an organizational development practitioner. I go into organizations and agencies and break down all the silos and checking what is actually working and what's not, what the cost is, and how to reduce expenditures. An example of that is a contract that we had that saved the government $4 million just by a simple redesign of the human resource program.
Very interesting. How long have you lived in the 50th Congressional District?
I came here in August of 2003, experienced a cedar fire and a couple other fires. And my friends were saying, come back to D.C. And I was like, no, I like it here.
It's even a real baptism by fire.
Yeah, that's a good one, baptism by fire. And I've enjoyed living in East County. I fell in love with Alpine, and I don't know if I'll ever leave permanently. I like to go on vacation.
Yeah, it's a beautiful community out there. So what are your top priorities if you're elected?
Well, the first priority for me is a national debt. I have been doing research through the Office of Management and Budget on the cost of the debt. So think about this. You have a credit card, and then you have another credit card, and you have maybe five credit cards, and you max them all out. You're basically going to pay more for the cost of the interest to have those credit cards and have credit. And that's what's happening with the federal government.
Right. The national debt right now is over $22 trillion, and 27% of that, according to your research, is owned by foreign companies. So what's your approach to solve that?
Well, we have to come together as a community, because one of the things is we need to look at the government programs we currently have and look for efficiencies in that. What is working and what is not? Doing that gap analysis and having Congress agree, which will be an interesting process, of course, but at least having the community agree that this is what works and this is what doesn't.
On environmental issues, you have called for reducing our dependence on fossil fuels and working toward a path for change toward a renewable energy future and cleaner air. Can you elaborate on how you would achieve those goals? And also, how concerned are you about global climate change and issues such as the burning of the Amazon rainforest that's happening as we speak?
The Amazon rainforest is the largest green space in the world. The Amazon is called the lungs of the world, and the green leaves, we need those. And when we have fires that are caused by natural or unnatural accidents, we need to help create methods to address those issues so that we're able to quickly reforest the areas that are burnt down. For example, in Paradise, that fire was devastating. And not only to the people, but to the environment, because the Sierra Range requires that green space. We need the greens from the trees to breathe better and greater air.
Right. Now, the other end of addressing climate issues is where our energy comes from. And obviously, the current administration is investing in, you know, more fossil fuels, coal, oil, gas, has pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accord, and is not investing in things like solar and wind. What do you think about that approach?
I really would like to own a house in East County where it's totally off the grid and run by solar electricity. And what that does is it disrupts the energy industry. And so we have large corporations influencing the federal government, such as the oil companies. Mm-hmm. And they're bidding for offshore oil drilling and other things that are currently going on in the nation.
What are some of the clean energy technologies? I saw a lot of them listed in the nice briefing paper that you sent us, so thank you for that. But some of the clean technologies that you think could be the wave of the future, and I know you've said could create jobs and new industries on their own.
Yes. For example, if we just have cars that run unlimited on a solar pack, wouldn't that be interesting? Then all of a sudden the oil industries, it would cause a disruption in the market.
So cars that wouldn't have to be recharged all the time, they're charging themselves as you drive down the road.
That would be pretty cool, don't you think? That's a dream of mine.
It would. They can make it happen.
Hey, they said that computers wouldn't work, right? And here we are today.
We've all got one, on our wristbands now.
Yes.
Wristwatches and cell phones. Who would have thought?
Who would have thought that little phone had all that information in it?
So you're for investing resources into things like solar and geothermal and wind and these technologies of the future that you just talked about.
Yes.
As opposed to more big subsidies for coal and fossil fuels.
I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I remember driving through Pittsburgh when I was a child, and it was pitch black, and the air quality creates problems for people in our communities when you use coal. And sometimes the gases create problems also. It also becomes an environmental concern if we have a gas main break and what is happening in those type of instances.
True, as well as water pollution.
Yes, and I am concerned about the water table in East County and the impact to the Kumeyaay Nation and to other people who rely on that water. And I have been examining different ways of repairing that. We still have to create more policies that are better for our communities.
You've talked about saving the County of San Diego money. I know you met with an Escondido mayor on some ideas for identifying overlapping services with the federal government, things like homelessness, unemployment, and Alzheimer's care. How would you achieve getting more money to the county, like you've talked about, mm-hmm. from federal resources, while being consistent with your vision of cutting federal spending and reducing the deficit?
One of the things that the Veterans Administration is attempting to do is bring more women and veterans into the healthcare system. The female population in the county who are veterans, they often don't use the VA, even with all the efforts. And so I have examined the differences between the homelessness issue and services provided by the VA. It's already budgeted for in the VA. So under Title 38, which is the federal law for VA benefits, there are certain things that can be paid for by the federal government that are budgeted for and already accounted for in the federal budget that the county would not have to pay for. And I've met with Omar Passons in my capacity as the chair of the San Diego Military and Veterans Advisory Council and David Estrella relating to housing and homelessness issues.
You have voiced concerns over the Social Security Trust Fund owning a good portion of the national debt. Do you believe the Social Security benefits should be protected for those who've already paid in, or for that matter, you know, for younger people coming up? And if so, how would you do that?
Well, one of the things that we need to look at is the actual national debt. Over my lifetime, they've been, quote, robbing the Social Security Trust Fund as IOUs to the trust fund. And we need to stop that. We need to not be austere, but stop spending money that we don't have. And not having a projected 144% gross domestic product in 2049 and 98% by 2030, according to the Office of Management and Budget. We need to be more realistic in our spending. I've heard other candidates say, oh, we need to take money from this program and put it into this, without even a thought of how to cut that program's costs.
Do you support cuts to Social Security benefits or raising, you know, the age at which you would qualify? Or do you think the opposite, that we just need to make it a priority to fund those programs?
We need to fund those programs. All of us who are 40, 50, 60 are facing the possibility of not having Social Security because of how the government has mismanaged the program.
Yeah, it's an interesting statistic that before we had Social Security, 50% of seniors lived below the federal poverty level, and after it dropped to 10%. So it has been an important program, and of course the cost of living is a lot higher now than it was when they started it. So
yes, definitely.
Gun violence has been a huge problem across the nation with all of these mass shootings and so forth. What are your views on how to reduce gun violence?
Well, the first thing is, I'm looking at issues. When I was married, my former husband had an AR-15, a Glock 9mm, Smith & Wesson. And as soon as we went to Guam and he went off to Korea in the military, I sold them because I knew that if we had that, we're going to shoot someone with it. And in Guam, they used to shoot bullets in the sky on New Year's when I lived there, and it made me nervous.
Yeah, so there can be some excesses. Where do you come down in terms of, I guess, the balance between Second Amendment rights versus, protecting the lives of everybody in our society?
Well, one of the things I know from personal experience, because both of my children are adopted, we adopted them in California, is that even with gun locks on the guns, children can get access to them. So that's my concern as to why I sold our weapons.
Mm-hmm. And so are you talking about things like background checks as opposed to, say, banning the sale of assault weapons, but just being more careful who gets these kinds of things, or what?
More careful about who gets those. There's an issue with military being able to go out and buy guns without background checks across the country. And this is not just a California issue, because a congressional rep is a national person that creates laws for everybody. Mm-hmm. And Senator Gillibrand and I, in her speeches about gun control, I agree that we need to tighten up the ATF alcohol and tobacco and firearms background checks. You should wait at gun shows for a few days to get that gun.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked to read that 40% of the guns sold in America are done without any background check at all. You could be completely mentally ill and have a record of domestic violence or whatever and be able to go into, say, a gun show and walk home with whatever you want.
Well, if elected to Congress, I would work with Senator Gillibrand mm-hmm. and others in Congress to change the laws for background checks. I believe that people have a right to bear arms. It's how we do it and how we do the background checks that makes the difference, because we are having people shooting other people for no reason, showing up with guns. So they say it's a mental health issue, but I think it's more of a policy issue in addition to illnesses.
What about Carl DeMaio has the idea of...
He said we should allow people, if I'm quoting it correctly from the article, we should allow people to conceal and carry as well.
Yeah,
a
national concealed carry policy. So we need more people carrying more guns everywhere, according to Carl DeMaio.
Well, it was funny. I put on Twitter, on his Twitter feed, whether he read it or not. I said, Carl, really? You know, guns? And I referred back to Kerry Good, who's from in Alabama as a football player and an NFL strength coach, who wrote an article for me. And the thing is that if you have a gun, you're going to shoot something. And if you're angry and out of control, you may shoot something that you shouldn't be shooting.
So it's just the potential for more people to do that.
Yes. And so it was kind of, to me, it was like, why? You know, we have other solutions that are more effective and efficient, such as the background checks.
Mm-hmm. We need to pause a moment for station identification. You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, The Scanso. And now we return to our interview with Helen Horvath, the independent candidate running in the 50th Congressional District against Duncan Hunter. San Diego is home to over 250,000 veterans and many military families as well. You have voiced special concerns, Helen, about women veterans who are more apt to commit suicide, to be homeless, to have mental health issues due to sexual trauma in the military, mm-hmm. and yet they are less apt to use the VA healthcare services, in part due to harassment problems at the facilities. So what are your plans to improve these problems for our women veterans who served our nation?
Well, I am part of the VetWow movement for military sexual assault. Mary Ellen Salazar, who's the founder of the Military and Family Collaborative in California, we talk about policies and issues and how to make changes. And I am going to work towards changing the policies within the VA relating to women's health care. There are laws out there that veterans don't know about, such as Women's Suicide Act of 2016. And they tend to promote, because of the population being primarily male, there's more of an attention on the male suicide issue.
Yeah, very interesting there. You have also noted that despite highly rated veterans' health care in San Diego County compared to many other parts of the country, the remote parts of the county, such as Julian, Borrego Springs, or Native American reservations, have veterans who face access challenges both for routine care and urgent care. What are your ideas for improving access for them?
Well, currently the Mission Act was published, which is the law, the new health care plan. The problem with the Mission Act is that remote areas that don't have CVS pharmacies or urgent care facilities, and there's a map on the VA website, if they don't have that, they have to either drive an hour somewhere or an hour and a half to go to a VA clinic, or they're forced to struggle with the VA in some of these issues. The benefit to our county is that some of the facilities like in Ramona and North County may be closed for some. but not all. And then in other areas of the country, like Roseburg, Oregon, they don't have an urgent care facility, and they have to drive an hour to an hour and a half. So on a national level, it is a national issue for access for all veterans.
Healthcare costs and access to affordable quality healthcare is one of the biggest issues named by many voters, certainly not just veterans or military families. Congressman Hunter has stated in his town hall last year or so up in Ramona that he believes healthcare is a privilege, not a right. On the other end of the spectrum, Amar Campanajar, the Democrat in the race, has proposed expanding Medicare in stages to allow people younger than 65 not to have it free, but to buy into the system, starting with those 55 and older. Some of the other candidates have criticized Obamacare or the Affordable Health Care Act, but they haven't really proposed a real alternative to it. So what is your strategy? Do you think action is needed to make health care more affordable and assure that everybody can access at least essential health care services they can afford, just like military veterans are entitled to do through the VA, at least in theory? And if so, how would you achieve that goal?
One of the things I've been examining is the implications between the Affordable Care Act, the marketplace, and Medicare and Medicaid. So there are people at lower incomes who qualify for Medicaid, and then there are people who qualify in the marketplace. But when we look at Amar Campanajar's desire, he said in his meeting 55 or older, and that's going to increase the federal debt. And I've done the analysis.
Now, how is it? Because he's saying people would pay into it. It's not a freebie, but you would pay something into it, but maybe it would be less than you're paying for, say, a private policy for those that are kind of getting gouged between age 55 and 65. So how does it increase the debt?
Well, when I examined the Office of Management and Budget's February 2019 report on the federal debt, there was $3.6 trillion in expenses for health care. And the income from Medicare, Medicaid, and the payments that come in from Medicare was only, I believe, 1.4 to 1.6 trillion. So that creates a minus of 1.4 to 1.6 trillion loss every year. And then when you add more people onto the plan, it creates more expenses for the government because the cost of the insurance increases depending on the services that are used and so on within the program, but also the premiums do not cover Medicare.
So is there a solution? Do we just keep going the way we are, where it's getting more and more expensive and more people are getting priced out of it, especially the middle class and folks that are a little bit older? How is it that every country on earth, every industrialized country in the world except the United States, has some form of universal health care or health care for all, and yet in our country it just keeps getting more and more expensive, so many people are paying more and getting less? Obamacare certainly wasn't perfect, but it was at least an effort to address that. Is there a solution? And if so, what would you do? Or if you could wave your magic wand and be president tomorrow, what would you do?
Well, that's a good idea. I could be president tomorrow and have some fun. I would wave my magic wand and everyone would be able to have affordable health care. And I know that's a general statement, but affordability based upon income is one of the things I look at. Mm-hmm. If someone is paying $2,000 a month for rent and making $4,000, that's 50% of their income for housing. And so if we look at the total cost of living and examine that and then come up with costs for healthcare plans and basically improve upon the services, because unfortunately not everyone has TRICARE in the military system, and where they have a $1,000 catastrophic cap, and once they pay that, they don't have to pay anything else the rest of the year. Or a veteran. Anyone who's a veteran would rather not have disabilities, but at the same time, they get health care through the VA. So I look at those two models, and I think we need, and I was a former health benefits advisor and involved in TRICARE Northeast in DC development of the program. And in that instance, I know how to examine the different impacts. For example, the cost for a podiatrist. What is the national average? They use Medicare rates. And so if we use in insurance the Medicare rates across the board, the doctors won't like that I'm saying
they're
this.
They're low, yeah.
Yet if we go towards the Medicare rate and not impact the Medicare benefit in these programs, it would reduce the cost to the consumer for healthcare.
What do you think about Medicare negotiating to purchase prescription drugs to help bring down the costs of things like, you know, insulin, or for that matter, there's been ideas floated about allowing Americans to buy prescription drugs from, say, Canada?
Well, the United States regulates drugs through the FDA, the Federal Right. Drug Administration. And it's done for like that for a reason, to protect the citizens, because sometimes the drugs you get overseas may not be, or outside the United States, may not be the same quality.
Yes, that's certainly true in some countries.
Yes, and so that's one thing to consider in this issue. But the other part is insulin for diabetics, the cost of Victoza, the cost of other diabetes drugs needs to come down. The monthly rate for one of the prescriptions is around $700 to $1,000 if you pay out of pocket. Mm-hmm. And even with the pharmaceutical companies helping some consumers, it still doesn't resolve the issue of the cost.
Yeah, and that's just medication. One example of a life-saving drug that more and more people can't afford. So how do you make the pharmaceutical companies make it more affordable when there's such a profit motive and so much gouging going on?
First thing is hold them accountable for the cost of the drugs and make sure that the amount that they're charging, even though it includes the cost of the research, is affordable to the community. They did that with the drug that was $5,000 mm-hmm. prescription, and it caused, the CEO brought the price up to, I believe, $5,000 a prescription, and then it went down once the community started complaining. So what I'm saying is that the community has the power to influence. And that's why I say come together, be the change, because it's influencing the outcomes for the drugs and insurance.
Okay, so you would handle it on sort of a case-by-case basis like that through the community stepping forward when there's an abuse.
That's the first thing, but the voices, when it goes to Congress, social media is pretty powerful. So once True. You get an issue on social media, it seems to be like everything explodes when it's a negative issue. So everyone has an opinion. And by giving their opinion, they're able to make a change.
Another controversial issue is immigration and border security. I would like you to address your views on these. And specifically, we can maybe take these one at a time, but like border security, including the wall.
I was twittering on Gonzalez Fletcher's website when she was putting up the issues about the wall. I kept saying, it's already there. It's not new. But Duncan Hunter's father made sure there was a wall up in East County. So I believe, just like in Europe and other countries, we need physical barriers. And also through that, we need to improve. What I would recommend is that we improve the quality of work standards for the Customs and Border Protection staff. In addition to that, use more technology to guard the border, such as the drones and other technology that's classified to Homeland Security, and support Homeland Security. We have an issue in this community where the federal government does not obtain information from the local government, and it impedes the ability to secure the borders.
What about comprehensive immigration reform, including things like the DREAM Act, as well as addressing here in San Diego County, there's now a shortage of agricultural workers because it's become so difficult for people to come here and fill those jobs?
I empathize with the Dreamers. I'm torn because in the 1980s, there was an amnesty program that basically allowed people to stay in the country. I agree with Homeland Security that coming here without authorization is illegal. Yet at the same time, we need to be able to weed out those people who have, for example, served with the military overseas.
The Dreamers, of course, are people who were brought here as children, even babies in some cases. So they weren't adults that made a choice on their own to mm-hmm. cross the border. So you wouldn't make an exception for, you know, the young people who've been here a lot of years. In some cases, they've got college degrees or jobs and so forth.
I think that people should be given the opportunity to be here. We haven't quite figured out, and I'm very torn about the Dreamer issue, because there are some people in the community who've gone on to get college degrees and so on. And I think that it's very important that we provide support for them. yet we have to do it within the context of the law, which is where I come in when elected. I can sit down and come up with policies that we take to Congress and say, this is a solution. And I'm still thinking about it. I've been thinking about this for 2 years because my parents were immigrants and waited 6 months in Vienna and were taken to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey as refugees. So yeah. They follow the normal route.
Yeah, it's probably one of the thorniest issues we face. And of course, there really isn't a normal route for people that are coming up from places like Central America and Mexico. There seems to be a little different standard for entry than if you're coming from Europe. But meanwhile, here in the San Diego region, the president's policies have, for better or worse, cut down a lot on the illegal immigration. There's a lot of people coming in seeking asylum, but the undocumented crossing of the border has fallen quite a bit. One of the impacts of that, of course, is that we're now seeing a shortage in certain industries, particularly agriculture. There was just a story a couple of days ago saying that some of the farms in San Diego are talking about maybe not being able to continue because they cannot find enough American workers to fill the jobs that used to be held by Mexicans or people that were coming over here. So do you support any kind of guest worker program or something like that to help fill those jobs?
Well, as far as I remember, there's a visa process that a person can apply to come into this country as a migrant worker. And they come from around the world to the country. But the other part is maybe it's time that since we're having such increases in cost of living and so on, and farmers have a profit margin, maybe they should pay the actual value of the work, because migrant workers are, from what I have read, are generally paid less than other people who come in.
Another aspect of the immigration issue that we're seeing right now is the large number of people, especially families with children, coming here seeking asylum from Central America, you know, claiming persecution and so forth. But there's been some big issues about the treatment of some of the children, especially in Texas facilities, mm-hmm. not as much in San Diego, but in some of these other facilities where there have been these horror stories in the news about kids kept for weeks without soap, without water. A government lawyer mm-hmm. actually arguing in court that they shouldn't have to give them soap, water, or showers, you know, health care, legal advice, and so forth. And then, of course, the family separation issue at the border. What are your views on that?
I worked for an immigration facility as a therapist in San Diego. They had great care, and that's in San Diego. Yet, it's a contract issue with those institutions. They have a requirement under their federal contract to provide services that if they don't meet it, then they shouldn't be contracted with. And I saw the images of Ocasio-Cortez and others visiting. I don't believe that's across the board in the system. Mm-hmm. It depends on the contractor. So as a congressional rep, I can go back and ask about those contracts and what's going on and make sure that they're adhered to.
And so you would try to fix the contracts in the places where the care has been substandard while keeping it in places where the care is better?
Well, I already know there are places where the care is better based on personal experience, but I think that's just one step, is to examine the contract. But then next, examine who is actually coming in, because there have been issues with people renting children to come up here and saying that they're their children.
That's one side of it. And then on the other side, there's families being ripped apart where,
yes.
for example, there have been children taken from a grandmother where they say, well, you're not a parent, so they've taken them away and put the children up for adoption. That's actually going on.
Well, I disagree with that. That's part of changing the entire immigration process. I would legislate to change those issues so that the families are taken care of. I'm all about family. It doesn't matter where you're from. It's just, again, the conundrum
yeah.
or the thought of what is the current law, and then how can we improve upon it to make it better?
Right. And while obviously protecting children who were
yes.
brought here by a trafficker or somebody
yes.
with ill intent.
You're listening to the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. And now we return to our interview with Helen Horvath, the independent candidate running in the 50th Congressional District against Duncan Hunter. Helen, as the only woman in this race, I would like to ask your views on women's health care issues, including abortion as well as access to birth control, at a time when we're seeing the federal government, the Trump administration, cutting all funding to Planned Parenthood, even for basic health services such as pap smears and mammograms, and we're one vote away on the Supreme Court from seeing Roe versus Wade overturned. Can you comment, please?
Yes, I sat in on the Republican Party meeting, and in order to be a Republican, I was told I had to believe in the value of life. I believe in the value of life. I also believe that women should have a right to choose. One of the candidates said that Planned Parenthood needs to go away. I use Planned Parenthood for gynecological uses when I was younger. They are so much more than abortions. I can't force my view on a woman. I don't like abortion. I value life. But I'm not going to tell another woman what to do. When I was growing up, before Roe v. Wade, women were conducting abortions using hangers. There were deaths. I'm not creating that statement. It's a fact. And it's one of the issues that comes up. The other part of this is how women are treated in society as a whole. So one of the other issues in this globally is female genital mutilation. And I don't want to get graphic with that, but it's basically women are mutilated, their genitalia is mutilated.
Yeah, terrible, really, torture of women, essentially, that's sanctioned in some societies.
Yes, and they come to the United States also, and they escape as immigrants coming here seeking safety. And that's one of the reasons that people should be allowed in this country when they're terrorized in other countries.
Yeah, there's certainly other women's issues, too. We've talked about veterans' issues. We've talked a little bit about, obviously, you support a right to women having access to health services, including birth control and so forth. There's also things like the Violence Against Women Act, which Congressman Hunter voted against until I'm told he was, you know, under some pressure from some of his donors to change his vote on that and eventually came out for it. But we're seeing, you know, more and more of the conservatives in the House that just seem to be rolling back all kinds of things. They can't even get an Equal Pay for Women Act through the Congress.
Well, one of the things I look at, because I'm an advocate for military sexual trauma, I have been a therapist who worked in the domestic violence field. I've seen it pretty much all. And we need to have laws and regulations to protect women, to strengthen those laws and regulations, to make sure that the crimes don't occur. And I'll talk about that more another time, but there are laws and regulations in the military, for example, that promote the 30,000 sexual assaults for both men and women in the military.
Yeah, and of course, the flip side on the whole abortion controversy is it's easy to say you're pro-life and work to protect, you know, fetuses, but what about children after they're born? It seems like there's this dichotomy to me where we see all of this emphasis on one side about mandating every birth, whether it's a, you know, severe birth defects or economic things. But what they forget is that the number one reason women give for going to an abortion clinic is that they say they can't afford to have a baby. So what about making sure that we have proper maternal health care, for example, or care for the child after it's born, so that a woman who maybe finds herself with an oops pregnancy doesn't feel like, you know, abortion is her only or her best choice, perhaps?
One of the things I advocate for with women is increased learning about healthcare. I don't know about you, but when I grew up, I didn't know the difference between whatever, and we took health class. It was interesting. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, the talk about sex and all this, the kids learn from each other, not so much from an education.
The internet. Who knows what they're learning?
Yeah. Yes, and the internet too. And there's also predatory behavior and things like that.
Right.
But if we stay focused on teaching adolescents and women health care, and no matter what your choice is, that health care, knowing how to access it, what the issues are, and learn about your body. There was a book I read when I was in high school, Women's Bodies, Women's Minds, something like that.
Yeah.
And it's a purple book, and it taught me about my body. And so women have to take control of their lives. They have to be the change. They have to advocate for themselves in healthcare. And we need to stand up and stop allowing
people to tell us what to do with our bodies.
Men, especially.
Yes, men especially, because I was so upset when Alabama passed that law that women could not have abortions. And I thought, what about if the child and the fetus does not have a spine or is missing a leg and their quality of life is impacted?
Or you have a 12-year-old who was raped by daddy. And then we're seeing places, you know, in some parts of the world now, this is actually happening, where we're seeing abortion that's been outlawed, and women who have miscarriages are being prosecuted for murder, you know, suspected of actually, you know, intentionally killing the fetus when in some cases it was actually a miscarriage, which can happen to anybody.
Well, I think that women should, especially women who are sexually assaulted, incest, molestation occurs, and they become pregnant, they should be permitted to have an abortion. Because a 12-year-old should not be raising a child. They're a kid raising a kid.
Right. It's got to be treated differently than maybe somebody who's 8 months pregnant and just suddenly decides, I don't want a baby after all. Those are kind of different circumstances, and it seems like a one-size-fits-all solution is just quite problematic for so many women who are victims of sexual violence, of rape, assault, incest, or simply victimized by finding out there's something terribly wrong with the baby, like it has spina bifida or no brain or something like that. And yet,
you have to carry it to full term. And it's traumatic for women who've been abused and assaulted to have to be forced to carry a child. Because when you look at that child, in some cases, the mother learns to love the child. Yet in some cases, it's a constant reminder and it causes more trauma to the woman. Some people say, oh, give it up for adoption. Yet 20 years later, 18 years later, when that child wants to know their parents, how is that mother going to be forced to explain what happened?
Well, and it's easy to say to someone else, give it up for adoption, but are you going to pay the $40,000 it costs to give birth to a child nowadays on average? I mean, that's an awful lot to ask of somebody who doesn't want or isn't able to keep the baby. So there's so many different dynamics and different issues. It's a lot of gray areas.
It also goes back to the issue of who's going to pay for the child growing up, their health care, and all of this. So I don't like abortion.
Yeah, I think anyone does.
I look at the realities. When you have someone who's going to be economically disadvantaged by having a child, 18, 19, 20 years old, not being able to feed that child, even with family support, who's going to pay for it? They end up on welfare, that food stamps, other programs like Medi-Cal.
Or going to Mexico, as used to happen, and getting an abortion illegally over the border. They used to have an incredible number of women who were treated at UCLA before Roe versus Wade. Many of them had been left sterile, had severe bleeding. Some of them bled to death or had infections where they actually died, young, you know, 15, 16, 18-year-old women.
And in my health class in high school, they told us this is what happens when you get an abortion, and they explained it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it also goes back to what we're teaching our children in school and how we're teaching sex ed. And I've been out of school for so long, I don't really know what they're teaching, but I can look it up and get back to you.
There's controversy over that, but we could do a whole other show
on
that.
Yes, we could. But I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this.
Yeah, it's very refreshing, I think, to have a woman candidate. You know, I've often thought if we had more women in politics, the world might be a better place.
Well, actually, I received some information from the Barbara Edwards Foundation about women running for office, of all things. And so I'm in conversation with them about other things I'm working on with regard to the candidacy.
Very interesting.
What do you view as our nation's most pressing foreign policy issues, and how would you address those in Congress if you could?
Well, I spoke to my friend, former Congresswoman Bordalio, and she reiterated to me the importance of Middle East peace. And we've been at war more than 220 years or 229 years out of our existence.
Yeah.
And we have an economy of war. So how do we change that? That's one thing. And then also, when we look at our financial relationships with different countries, we're paying $3 billion, I believe, a year to Israel for foreign aid. It's necessary to prop them up and help them out. We're in the Middle East all the time,
and we're at war consistently. We're providing our support to different countries. So Middle East is a priority.
Yeah, I just saw a story today that said that ISIS is starting to make a comeback there again now that we've pulled out. You know, there's some revamping on their part, so that's certainly a concern.
The other part of the Middle East is who's paying for most of the war costs? And it is our country.
Right.
Even though we have these partners, America pays the bulk of it. So that goes back to the issue of the federal budget, our debt, and who we're supporting. I'm not preaching isolationism. I'm saying that we need to look at home first, see what we need, and then after that, just like you would in your regular budget, then start giving money out. And so it would take an examination of that issue. And then the other issue is China, Ireland, Japan, and those other countries, they hold the majority of our debt. And here we are arguing with China over tariffs.
Yeah.
So it gets very interesting when we look at national policies. But what Madeline said was the most important thing was Middle East peace and peace for our country. And that's why if I'm elected to Congress, I would want to be on the House Armed Services Committee to basically help guide the federal government's efforts in wars and Department of Defense contracting, because my expertise in contracting is really deep. I love the federal acquisition regulation. So I can basically go in and examine contracts and pick apart where they're overspending, because I've done that before
very
in other contracts.
Yeah, that would be a novel concept for Congress, I think.
I think it would too.
You have listed on the briefing you sent us a few specific policy differences with your primary opponents in this race. Can you take just a minute and tell us a couple of your key differences from Congressman Hunter, as well as Democrat Amar Campanajar, and for that matter, the Republicans Bill Wells, Mayor Bill Wells of El Cajon, and radio host Carl DeMaio, Navy SEAL Larry Wilsky. I believe those are the ones that you
yes.
listed.
So first, I want to say that I respect and honor Margaret Hunter for stepping up to state the truth in the legal battles around her husband.
Mm-hmm.
I respect the fact that Duncan Hunter served in the Marines, but he's already been asked by the Marines not to mention them in his campaign. It was publicly stated. I think it's less painful for our community.
Well, I should correct, not to mention his service, but not to use the Marine Corps seal or slogan as he was doing, which is a violation of federal
yes.
law.
Yeah, well, it is a violation of federal law unless you have permission, mm-hmm. and it's intellectual property. But the other part is I realize the 50th District is tired of all of the backbiting and fighting between the different parties. And beyond that, I realize that the 50th District follows the news and issues around that. So I don't want to go negative other than I understand what the issue is.
So do you think he's done a good job or not of addressing the day-to-day issues that people in the 50th Congressional District are facing?
I spoke to some congressional friends who were with him on trips and things like that, and he hasn't done his job as a congressional rep, and I don't want to argue with him, but I have the backup to that information. I just don't want to name names because they're friends of mine in Congress.
What about the Democrat in the race, Amar Campanajar?
Well, I attended his meeting out of curiosity. I've never seen him speak. Mm-hmm. And I heard him say that he would support businesses moving on to the reservation in order to avoid federal, state, and local business taxes.
Yeah, there's an idea to help prevent businesses from leaving California due to high California state taxes.
Yes, but there are also federal taxes they have to pay. And what happens when you're on the reservation is you don't have to pay taxes on the reservation. At least in California, Navajo Nation charges a tax. But in California, you don't have to pay a business tax. Yet when you conduct business off the reservation, you have to pay federal, state, and local tax.
So this would actually be sort of draining the tax coffers by doing that?
Yes, most definitely. And it would definitely reduce the income to the state, which is concerning as a policy. Well, if we can go back to Amar, it was really cool. He talked about SpaceX coming into the county, and I had images of rockets flying over East County when he was very excited about that.
Yeah, cowboys and aliens, he said.
Cowboys and aliens. And the reality is SpaceX is already in our community. Anyone can sign up to be a diversity supplier.
What about the Republicans in the race besides Duncan Hunter, Mayor Bill Wells, radio host Carl DeMaio, and Navy SEAL Larry Wilsky?
Well, when I look at Carl DeMaio, I actually met him earlier this summer. I called and asked for a meeting before I decided to run. And one of the things, he has a specific policy for veterans and national security, including increases to the Department of Defense budget, because the only way he can do what he wants to do is return to the basic war fighting only, is what was stated. And he's increasing the national debt unless he plans to cancel programs for military families, veterans, and active duty members. It goes back to that Office of Management and Budget report that I mentioned earlier.
So he's not really a fiscal conservative in your view?
In my view, no. Based on his plans, no. Because, as you know, $800 trillion in defense spending was added by the Republicans to the budget.
Good
the president.
Point. Yeah, that's true. What about Mayor Bill Wells from El Cajon?
Well, I met Mayor Wells earlier this summer regarding veterans issues in the county. We share a lot in common professionally before he became a mayor. Yet on veterans issues, unfortunately, he does not have the grasp that I do on the veterans issues due to my activities in the community. He has proposals and ideals, which are fine.
How about Navy SEAL Larry Wilsky?
Oh, Larry Wilsky is a lovely Navy SEAL.
Yeah, retired Navy SEAL.
Retired Navy SEAL. Mm-hmm. I know quite a few Navy SEALs. I know a chaplain who was a Navy SEAL. Yet when I met with Larry Wilsky, I told staff at the first Republican meeting that I attended, I told his staff I was going to run for office. They said, you should talk to him anyway. So I called up, made an appointment, and we met at Starbucks in Alpine. And I asked him what he would do for the veterans. And he said that the VA needs to have a sick call, which in military terms means you go in the morning, sit around, wait to get care, and then leave. So unfortunately, that's not how it works with the new Missions Act. They actually have a program that allows you to go to urgent care, doesn't cost you anything based on your status. Max you would pay is $30 a visit. He was not knowledgeable about those issues.
Very interesting. And we should mention there are a couple of other candidates who've talked about running, but they haven't really formally launched campaigns. Some of them had said they would only run if Duncan Hunter is not in the race. And now with his trial postponed until January, he says he's not resigning. And the filing deadline is coming up soon in December.
Former Congressman Daryl Issa, who does not live in the district, has said that he would run, but only if he does not get his ambassador position. He was appointed by President Trump, approved by the Senate by early November.
But we're just focusing today on those who've said they're running no matter what. Several candidates have filed campaign committees. They've listed with the, you know, FEC or FPPC and so forth. But the actual deadline to formally enter the race with the registrar of voters is in December. So that's what we're all looking at to see really who's in and who's out. Now, other candidates in the race, some of them, have already amassed millions of dollars in their campaigns with backing from national political parties, in the case of Amar Campanijar, or well-heeled donors in some of the other cases. What is your strategy to compete against that? How would you raise funds and run a viable campaign since you're not aligned with either of the political parties?
So what we've done is reached out to the veteran community, women veteran communities, and my NFL friends, because I worked helping the NFL athletes with head trauma issues and so on. So I have support from NFL individuals, and I have support around the country, not just in the county. So we just started our campaign because I wanted to clear up the requirements I have for committees and so on, to make sure that I wasn't in conflict with my responsibilities. So we opened up, and we're collecting money every week from individuals, and we're going to keep pushing for publicity, marketing, advertising. We have a marketing person working with us, and we've been going on Twitter. I'm not a Twitter fan, so we just open the Twitter site, and we get people coming every day. We've been going on Facebook and having people join our Facebook page from local communities, Lakeside, and so on.
Do you believe that having more independents in Congress, we should note there's one right now that I know of, Bernie Sanders, so obviously it's been done at least once, and he's been a pretty popular guy, I guess. Do you think that having more independents in Congress could help reduce the partisan divide that we see where so often neither side is willing to compromise and the result is gridlock and government shutdowns and nothing getting done.
Well, one of the things I want to remind everyone is when we have a shutdown to the government, it actually costs the government more.
True.
And work is not being done and so on. And so that's an issue. But I believe that we need more independence and independent candidates in Congress because the parties are so mired in their fighting and trying to bring Trump down and then trying to hurt the other party and whoever is running. Members of Congress are fighting, for example, Ocasio-Cortez, the Squad. They're not representing the country, and they're not independents. They're Democrats. And then you have their efforts to spending millions of dollars on investigations. It's not effective government. It creates this circus. My mother grew up, learned English by watching soap operas. So we're in an American soap opera every day. And I don't know about you, but I'm tired.
Yeah, and then the other side of the coin, we have Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, just refusing basically to introduce any bill and let people vote on it if it's authored by a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very true. And an independent is able to walk both sides of the aisle and work through the problems. And I'm an organizational development practitioner, so I actually go into organizations and assess behaviors, and it helps me be more effective when talking to people and getting them to follow me. I want people to follow me for the right reasons, that I can do the job.
Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking with Helen Horvath, who is running as an independent candidate, not affiliated with either political party, for the 50th Congressional District seat currently held by Congressman Duncan Hunter. Helen, we are almost out of time. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know that I haven't already asked you about yourself or your candidacy?
Well, I value our community. I want to serve the people, to help us go out to different communities, gather signatures. We're working to collect 2,500. We're only required to collect 2,000 signatures. But if we can get to that 2,500 signature level, I think we're going to be really good. And my goal in the campaign is not to spend campaign dollars on forms and costs such as that, but it is to reach out to the community.
How can people learn more information about your candidacy? Do you have a website or a Facebook page they can look up?
Oh, definitely. We're at horvathcampaign.com.
And that's spelled H-O-R-V-A-T-H.
Campaign.com. And we're also on Twitter at @ForHelen. So join the conversation if you have questions. I'm on there a couple times a day seeing what's going on. And also we're on Facebook, and just log in for Horvath for Congress in Facebook. It's one of the pages on my site.
And that's spelled H-O-R-V-A-T-H.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed our time together.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.